if you try and engage in an agreement with somebody else in order to take substantial steps towards committing some form of crime, then you've conspired in sort of the legal sense.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Ben Pauker, FP's executive editor for The Web, and you're listening to The ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined by Ben Wittes and Susan Hennessy of Lawfare. Ben Wittes is the editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Susan Hennessy is the managing editor of Lawfare. She is also a fellow in national security and governance studies at Brookings. ER nerds, we love hearing from you. Have episode ideas or comments? You can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio, high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. So I'm thrilled for ER nerds and foreign policy readers to announce that Foreign Policy and Lawfare are entering into an exclusive partnership. And Ben and Susan, it's so nice to have you guys as part of the team. And you guys are going to be writing columns for us. We're going to be co-publishing some of the great stuff that you guys have on Lawfare. And if ER nerds and listeners, you guys don't know about Lawfare, you will soon. They do some of the best stuff in legal analysis and national security that you can read anywhere. And it's a pretty awesome addition to what FP is doing, so we're thrilled to have you guys. You guys also do your own podcast, Rational Security, which we're going to be distributing to FP listeners. So we're psyched about that. But let's get into the Russia investigation stuff.
We're excited about it.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you guys. So there's no one better to ask about this stuff. There have been a few, I don't know, bombshells, semi-bombshells, scoops.
It's hard to even know how these things land anymore, right? You sort of, you know about a story ahead of time. You think like, this is it. This is a bombshell.
This and is going to take him down.
It doesn't get much sort of, I don't know, pickup. And then a story that you're kind of like, well, we pretty much already knew that is presented in a new way. And like, it's front page news all over. It's, at least for me, it's been incredibly hard to predict like what is significant.
So I don't do the prediction stuff in terms of, you know, what the effect is going to be because I, you know,
I just report the news.
No. It's not that. That's not what I was going to say at all. Last year, I so lost confidence in my predictive ability about everything. I just don't do. But I will say that the stories that have come out this week, in my opinion, are objectively highly significant. And so, look, as we're sitting here, Friday morning. The Wall Street Journal yesterday put out a story that provides what, to my mind, is the first concrete evidence, not conclusive evidence, not quite sure what it means, but it's some kind of concrete evidence of something that a reasonable person would look at and say that looks like collusion between people associated with the Trump campaign and people associated with Russian hackers who steal emails. And that is precisely the thing that for months and months, defenders of the president have said there's no evidence of. And they've cited the absence of evidence of that as a highly significant absence. And it's a really weird story, but it does get you part of the way to precisely the thing that is said to not be there.
So give us like the quick 30, 45-second backstory on – this is Shane Harris's scoop in the Journal.
Yeah, so this is – it's a scoop that Harris has written about, and I think, you know, we're recording early, but, you know, there might be sort of additional elaboration as well over the coming days, or listeners might know more than we do by this point. But essentially the allegation is that Peter W. Smith, who's like an opposition researcher, a Republican opposition researcher, unclear the level of his connection to the campaign. That's not unusual for opposition researchers, right? They're sort of quasi-consultants in lots of circumstances. So unclear how tied he is to the campaign, but he allegedly sort of made overtures to individuals within the information security community, essentially saying that he believed he was in contact with individuals who might have had emails obtained from Hillary Clinton's private server. So these are different from the DNC emails that were released through WikiLeaks.
Right. This isn't the Podesta stuff.
Exactly.
This is the emails that they were digging around to try
right,
and
that
find
she, that she had deleted, saying that they were private and non-responsive to document requests. And Jim Comey has testified under oath that there was no evidence that the private server had ever actually been compromised. But for whatever reason, this individual, Peter Smith, believes that it has been and believes that he's in contact with people who might have these emails and that they might be Russian. And so he starts asking...
There were a number of groups that he had allegedly been in contact with, right?
Right. So he's essentially kind of trying to get these emails, trying to verify their authenticity. He's also doing something really interesting, which is that he's representing that he is working with, on behalf of, knows, right? He's sort of intimating that he has a connection to Michael Flynn and to Michael Flynn's son. So this is sort of the first kind of concrete allegation that there is that, hey, not only is there steps towards collusion or conspiracy or whatever sort of legal rubric we're going to think about it under.
And this was back last summer, right? When Flynn was already working for the campaign.
Yeah, so this
already...
is while in September.
Oh, late.
So,
yeah.
And interestingly, it follows, remember, Donald Trump in July in a speech publicly said, you know, to the Russians, if you have those missing Hillary Clinton emails, I'd love to see them. And that's what this campaign was about. It wasn't about DNC emails. It was about the missing emails from Hillary Clinton's private email servers, which, you know, of course, the FBI says there's no evidence weren't deleted, as Hillary Clinton says, or that were in fact hacked, but there is a world in which that is not believed. And
yeah, I mean, look, just to make this this story as weird as possible. So Smith talks to Shane Harris at the Wall Street Journal, and a month later dies.
Now, 10 days later.
Now
that
the guy
sounds like that sounds like the way the Russians.
It's
operate.
Very Russian-esque. Yeah. Now the guy's 81 years old. There's not any evidence of foul play or allegations, but it does add sort of a level of bizarreness to the situation. It also makes it incredibly significant if there are other individuals that can corroborate this story, right? So his associates, other people that he's working with that either can speak to the level of his relationship with the Trump campaign, right? Because that's going to be the real tie here, the what did the president know and when kind
Everyone
of
stuff. Uses surrogates and people who aren't officially connected, but whether Smith was really in, you know, deep conversation with Flynn and others is going to be the question.
Right. The other thing that's going to be important here is, you know, look, whenever we start talking about the world of criminal law, which we might be talking about here, attempt is actually, it doesn't require that he actually be talking to Russian hackers. It doesn't mean that the server actually needs to have been hacked. If these allegations are genuine and if his sort of connection to the campaign is genuine, the mere fact of attempts or efforts might end up being really significant, sort of separate and apart from the underlying accuracy of whether or not he was talking to someone who was trying to trick him, if these really were Russian hackers. Obviously, that changes the story, but I think this really has the potential to move the investigation forward in very substantial ways.
So there's two other variables here that are, I think, really significant. So one is that there are these three very innocent-looking paragraphs in the Wall Street Journal story, which report that there is U.S. intelligence reporting based on apparently spying on Russian hackers, that there is a group of Russian hackers who was trying to figure out a way to get through a cutout Hillary Clinton emails to General Flynn. So they don't mention Smith. They don't mention that it's the same operation as Smith described to Shane Harris, but they do describe something that seems like the same thing taking place in roughly the same time period. But I think it's fair to say that the ball is not static here. It is actually moving on the field.
So for a, you know, you guys are both lawyers.
I'm not.
How
Get
dare
out.
You say
I am not
lawyer.
Now, nor have ever been a lawyer. And
you fake it really
a
well.
A common misconception,
You're a journalist, aren't you?
I am a legal journalist.
Yeah, God, that's the worst. It's the worst of both worlds. So help me understand, if Smith were talking to supposed hackers, right? And maybe those hackers were Russian. And let's put aside the presumption that they may have been operating under the aegis of the Russian government or in service of the Russian government. Is just simply asking, hey, guys, do you have any Clinton emails? Is that a crime? I mean, I think collusion is almost a separate...
Well, so collusion is a fake word. Collusion is actually a term of art in law, but it's in antitrust law when two companies get together to fix prices illegally, right? There's no such thing as collusion in this context. I'll let Susan talk about the law. But I want to say there's three really important factual variables here before you get to the law. So the first is, was this guy Smith really operating independently, or was he operating in coordination with or on behalf of somebody associated with the campaign, right? Because if he's independent, it kind of doesn't matter what he did, right?
Unless he were able to obtain these emails and then give them to the campaign and they accepted them.
Right, but right? There's apparently no evidence of anything like a real email, right? So the first question is, what is the relationship between Smith and Flynn and the campaign? The second question is, were the people on the other end of these exchanges real Russian hackers, or were they, you know, some...
Maybe they were a 400-pound kid on a bed.
On a bed. Somewhere.
Exactly. In a fun twist.
Exactly. You know, could these people have been delusional and being taken for a ride by, you know, some clowns they found on the dark web? And then the third question is, are there any actual emails at issue here? These guys were completely convinced that they were talking to people, that Hillary Clinton's email server had been hacked and that they could recover these emails. But
is that almost irrelevant, though, right? Is the attempt in and of itself to, you know, break into or, you know, abet the break-in to a private server, I assume that that's a crime. You know, that's, I imagine, what Mueller and others will be looking at.
Right. So now we're moving into sort of the legal stuff. And okay. We should tread carefully only because the facts aren't sufficiently developed. And actually, we've seen the problem with sort of putting out a legal term and everybody like sort of latching onto it with collusion. And then all of a sudden, you know, we end up with this sort of weird discussion about, well, collusion, it's not illegal and it's an antitrust. And well, look, there's collusion in the non-legal sense. There's coordinating either covertly or overtly in a way that is inappropriate, that Congress might decide to hold the president accountable for, right? There's sort of a whole non-legal, sort of the lawful but awful world in which really bad or really unacceptable or inappropriate things might have happened that just have nothing to do with sort of statutory law. That's kind of bucket one. Then there is conspiracy, right? So conspiracy before or after the fact. And that's when you plan to commit a crime or you plan to insist someone after they've committed a crime. So look, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, there's money laundering statutes, right? I mean, you could sort of, you could come up with any wild hypothetical. I don't even know that it counts as wild these days because it's all so crazy. You know, but if you try and engage in an agreement with somebody else in order to take substantial steps towards committing some form of crime, then you've conspired in sort of the legal sense. Then there's a sort of a third bucket, and that's espionage. And that's what, you know, Ben and I actually have been talking about this exact issue just this morning. And that's when your sort of your secret agreement is with a foreign government and sort of meets particular types of definitions and activity, then you're starting to get into the world of having potentially committed espionage. So this is way down the road in terms of, like, we aren't anywhere near the facts that sort of reach us to that point. But this does move us away from, well, we're only talking about collusion in this kind of, did you do something that's, like, really unseemly, really ugly, and maybe there's smoke that there's illegality into? You know, no, people are starting to make very specific allegations about the types of coordination that at least would cause a reasonable person to start thinking in those legal, frankly, criminal terms. And don't forget that Senator Sheldon Whitehouse last week said that he thought there was abundant evidence, I don't know what sort of his word was, that he believed Flynn was cooperating with the FBI. And so the FBI might know quite a bit more in this situation than anyone in the public. We should all hope that they do.
Well, we have to presume that the special investigator, Robert Mueller, already has these emails. Is that right? Or, you know, or at
emails
least
meaning
from Smith to...
I do not think we should assume that. I mean, I have very, very high regard for Mueller's people and for Mueller himself, but it's not clear to me how much of this information was part of the public, was part of the investigative discussion before. And it strikes me as very possible. Sometimes journalists, you know, give tips to investigators by publishing things, and I would not presume that that this is something that was on a parallel track with any investigation. It may well be that this is something that Shane and the Wall Street Journal have actually put on the public agenda.
So, you know, it strikes me that, you know, the operative word in at least part of James Comey's testimony was Trump saying that he hoped that he would take it easy on Flynn in the FBI investigation. Trump getting up on a campaign rally and saying in that crazy line, what was it like, Russia, go get these emails from Hillary. If that is the only piece, and it certainly seems like the only piece of public evidence, unless I'm forgetting something, where Trump was, you know, actively and publicly, publicly colluding with the Russians to get these emails, right, to interfere in the campaign. And there may have been something else that he said. It strikes me that the important thing is trying to find out, you know, to what extent Trump directed his subordinates, Flynn and others, and then they directed these, you know, surrogates or other people like Smith to engage in this sort of, you know, this hunt for the emails or for the leak, you know, Roger Stone and the WikiLeaks. Right.
So, I mean, I don't think it needs to be sort of, you know, somebody under my direction and control. I tell you to do this and you go out and do it. I think
isn't
it's
that important
awareness,
for the legal...
You know, look, the word nobody is saying but is sort of in the background here is impeachment, which is a political judgment, not a legal one. And so whenever we're talking about sort of to what extent is this administration going to be held accountable for these things, we're not necessarily talking about sort of pure statutory law. And that probably does reduce down to, look, if no matter what happens, if Trump, you know, can both say that he didn't know and no possible reasonable person would have known, and whenever he found out, he responded appropriately, it might be hard to hold him accountable. You know, we've had other presidential administrations where there's been scandals that they didn't know anything about, and they've usually had less accountability, although not none. That said, you know, this sort of one of the interesting but overlooked things in James Comey's written testimony was that he said that the president told him, well, you know, if other people in my circle engaged in something, did something untoward, then we should get to the bottom of that, right? Sort of hinting that he was at least open to the possibility somebody did something inappropriate. We've seen him over and over again, as soon as a scandal erupts, sort of immediately distancing himself. You know, I barely know that guy. I mean, he tried to do it with Paul Manafort, who was his campaign manager, that he was sort of this peripheral figure. And so I agree that the question of sort of the closeness, what he knew, what he was aware of, is going to become a central issue, in part because it's going to be the hardest one to prove or establish. And so I think that as more and more and more evidence comes out into the public, and we're in sort of the court of public opinion, that's where the Trump campaign is going to have to retreat to.
So I actually think about this completely differently. I don't think about these stories and these incremental developments in terms of where they get us to, in terms of Trump's individual knowledge or culpability or whatever. Because, first of all, I don't know. And second—
And you're not a lawyer.
That's never stopped me. I just don't know. And I think the information has value if the truth here has value, whether it clears Trump, whether it implicates a whole lot of people below him but shields him from, you know, or whether it implicates a large group of people, including him. And, you know, from my point of view, this begins and ends with the fact that something extraordinary happened in the fall. which is that a foreign intelligence service tried to interfere in our elections, did interfere in our elections, and that there appears to have tried to penetrate a major presidential campaign, appears to have, to one degree or another, succeeded at that in the terms of developing a lot of relationships, in terms of and that that presidential candidate associated with that campaign took public positions way outside of the mainstream in the department of favorable to the country that was doing that activity, and then won, and then appointed to the senior levels of his administration people who had to then step down, or at least one person who had to then step down, because he hadn't been truthful about his relationship to that foreign power. And I look at that constellation. None of those facts are contested. Except I suppose Donald Trump still sometimes, when he's not claiming that Obama should have done more about it, he contends that the Russian hacking didn't happen. But basically nobody contests any of those facts. And from my point of view, those facts cry out for clarification of the truth, the broad truth. And that truth may have criminal elements. It may have, it certainly has public policy elements. It has counterintelligence elements. It has how do we want to prevent something like this from happening again elements. And it has international elements in terms of our relations with that adversary foreign power and some other powers.
They're going to be handshaking at the G20 in Hamburg in what, a week or so?
Apparently they have no agenda. I haven't thought about it.
Correct. And I want, and this is exactly the point, I want the public and I want personally to know how to understand when they shake hands and smile at each other, to be able to make appropriate judgments about how to understand that. And if the totality of that understanding is Donald Trump had nothing personally to do with it, he's just a Russophile who surrounded himself with some Russophiles and they some of them engaged in some inappropriate activity, I'm fine with that as the answer. And if the answer is that, you know, Donald Trump turned a blind eye to some egregious activity that was going on in his campaign, I can live with that answer. And if the answer is Donald Trump himself engaged in some egregious improprieties other than the ones we know about in public, I'm fine with that answer. And I really just want to see both the criminal and counterintelligence side, which are conducted by the national security, by the Mueller investigation now, and the congressional and public policy sort of public accountability side, which are the province of the congressional investigations. I just want to see those come to the best answers that they can so that we can understand how to process what happened to us in the last 18 months.
That is very utopian to imagine that the congressional investigations that are ongoing right now will actually result in anything beyond a sort of shining a spotlight on
I actually want to say a word in defense of the Senate, of both congressional intelligence committees in this regard. The House Intelligence Committee had a disaster of a start because the chairman behaved like a partisan bomb thrower and a crazy person. This would be Devin Nunes. And he disgraced the committee, and he needs to answer for that. But the ranking member has been admirable, excellent, and serious. And actually, when Nunes stepped aside for purposes of this investigation, Mr. Conway has done, I think, quite a fine job of working with Schiff on restoring seriousness to that investigation. And I think we've learned material as a result of the House investigation. The Senate investigation has really been a model of how you would want, in a highly polarized partisan atmosphere, members of Congress to behave. And I think Richard Burr is not getting enough credit right now for the dignified, serious, and substantive investigation that he's presided over. And Warner, the ranking member, or they call it the vice chairman on the intelligence committees, has done a really excellent job of working with him, and they've produced consistently interesting, valuable information. And so I want to say a word in defense of the perform. I know Congress is the most popular, unpopular institution in the country, but they're actually doing a pretty good job in this space.
Yeah, look, I mean, I tend to agree. I think there are just natural limitations. And Ben and I have written a little bit about this. But look, those investigations are, I do believe, being conducted in good faith. I have more reservations. I don't think Nunes has recused himself in any sort of meaningful way. And his continued involvement is very unclear and very, very problematic to me. But I do agree that that investigation is occurring, right? To sort of assume it's a sham is not. And I think the SSA investigation is occurring in good faith. They've hired a number of new individuals, including April Doss, who was the former head of intelligence law at NSA while I was in the general counsel's office, somebody of remarkable knowledge about the areas and institutions of interest here.
And a sometime Lawfare writer.
And sometimes writes for Lawfare, although maybe she can't these days. Although you can if you want to. So that's right. So, the outward signs is that this is a serious investigation being undertaken by serious people. That said, they don't have enough money. They don't have enough resources. It is still a political activity, right? So we know that sort of when Burr's feet have really been put to the fire by the White House and sort of directing him to have particular calls with reporters. Again, Shane Harris, who I guess keeps popping up in these things, the Wall Street Journal story about killing sort of a New York Times report about, I think they called it constant communication between Trump officials and Russian intelligence agents, actually. You know, so we've seen him have some missteps, but then sort of rise again to the occasion. Really excellent lines of questioning in their hearings. So again, I think there's positive and negative signs there. That said, if Mitch McConnell was an individual who really wanted to get to the bottom, to the truth of the matter, he would establish a special select committee for the Russia investigation. Not an independent bipartisan commission. I know everyone loves it, but a serious select committee that was staffed by members that cared about getting to the truth, had credibility with the public, and had credibility with one another.
So how would that be different, just for those who don't understand all the different investigations? How would that commission be different, say, than the Mueller investigation or the two standing committees that already were looking at this?
It would be nothing like the Mueller investigation in the sense the Mueller investigation has two essential functions. One is that it's taken over the counterintelligence function of that the FBI was performing. And the second is that it's doing whatever criminal investigations. Now, you can't set up a special a special select committee can't have criminal jurisdiction because it's a congressional function.
And they aren't mutually exclusive.
Right.
This is executive branch versus legislative.
Look, the standing committees of jurisdiction in the Senate and the House generally are not staffed the way you staff a special committee, a special investigative committee. So if you think about the big investigative committees, you staff them like an investigation. I mean, think of staff numbers in the tens. Right, versus the Senate Intelligence Committee has staff numbers on each side, probably, I don't know, 7 to 10 people, maybe a little more. And they can kind of borrow people as needed. But, you know, I think if you were imagining investigating this the way a select committee would do it, you would probably have 25 or 30, you know, people working on it full time. And you also wouldn't have competing priorities. The intelligence committees have all the other stuff that they do, the intelligence community oversight stuff, as well as a major legislative project going on right now, which is the FISA 702, one of the big programs that a lot of the Snowden leaks dealt with, is expiring at the end of the year and needs to be reauthorized. And that's going to require a lot of attention from the two committees. And so imagine a committee that is much more robust in staffing and much less divided in its attention.
But we're probably not going to see that, Susan. You're not hopeful.
I think that's unlikely. Look, ultimately, this is going to reduce down to sort of the pure political calculations. As long as Republicans control Congress, they are not going to do things like have a serious select committee investigation or, by the way, do things like vote for impeachment until they are personally concerned about their own seats or they're concerned about losing control of Congress. Those are sort of, it doesn't really matter how much popular support there is for Trump's impeachment or how big the bombshell is that drops. At the end of the day, that is the thing that they are looking at, their own constituents and whether or not they are going to face accountability. That's, you know, it's a little bit of a harsh way to look at the situation, but I think it's important to have some realism and then to be realistic about ultimately, even for the good members, the ones that we like or the ones that don't appear to be sort of Trumpists, that's what the calculation reduces down to.
So among journalists, among the, you know, the watching public, after the Comey testimony, which was riveting but didn't end up with, you know, a smoking gun, the Sessions testimony was obfuscating. But there was a little bit of deflation, like, oh, we didn't get it. And I think people forget. The Nixon reporting came out in drips and drabs and drips and drabs and drips and drabs, and they followed that for, what, a year, year and a half. You know, is that what we're going to see? Is that what Shane's reporting is now? Do you guys get the sense? I know I'm asking for sort of like the known unknowns.
So this is good. This gives us an opportunity.
Do we still pull in string?
This gives us a chance to ensure that you, as the editor, do not cut out a piece that I really like about our first column, so we can stake it out, and then you're just stuck with it.
Fine. Now that we're on the record.
Exactly. Now you can't do anything. You know, but we're sort of planning on addressing these issues, and one of the things that Ben, the metaphor he offered yesterday, which I think is exactly the right one, is sort of the boiled frog that, it's not scientific. The frog would jump out of the water, but you know, if you put a frog in boiling,
really?
That's true. Yes, if you put the proverbial frog.
It's so warm. It's so nice.
The slandered frog, who's actually much smarter than,
exactly.
than the metaphor gives him credit for.
That if you throw the frog into boiling water, it'll jump right out. But if you raise the temperature slowly, allegedly the frog would just sit there until he was boiled to death. Apparently, frogs are actually smarter, and they would jump out at some point. But that's right, that if we actually got all this information at once, if it was sort of suddenly visited upon us, that we had a national security advisor that had these contacts and lied about them and the way Trump responded and the things he did in public and sort of all the things that we already know that are actually not contested facts, we would be stunned. We would be overwhelmed by what an unbelievable story this is, how shocking and frightening and unbecoming of the office of the presidency it all is. But that because it's been incremental.
We've already, that sounds fairly familiar, actually. Yeah.
But it's been one story after another. And it does have that sort of rising temperature feel to it in which it's hard to really appreciate the gravity of the situation because it's just happening slowly.
So I agree with that. And I also think the ultimate answer to your question, are we going to get, the single revelation that is itself so catastrophic that it's unsurvivable? The simple answer is, who knows? I would have thought that in a different context about the Access Hollywood tape during the campaign. Mm-hmm. And if you'd asked me a year ago, is it possible to tweet about a prominent talk show host that she's crazy, stupid, and is bleeding from the face and survive that as a national political figure, I would have said, don't be stupid. You can't do that. And yet it's 24 hours after the president tweeted that about Mika Brzezinski, and nobody's talking about it anymore. I really don't purport to have any insight into what ultimately the president can and can't survive. I come back to the fact that that's actually not my department. You know, my department is to try to understand the legal and policy significance of the information that's coming out and to, try to give people a window through which to understand it.
Well, I have to admit, I'm asking for for purely selfish reasons, since I'm going away on vacation next week. Just give me one
week. Relax. Turn off the phone.
It's going to be a busy week.
So on that little bit of a cliffhanger and down note, I think we'll leave it. We'll have you guys back soon. We're super psyched to be starting this great partnership with Lawfare. Ben, Susan, thank you guys. We're thrilled to have you guys on board.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, and we're excited about working with you.
You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Ben Pauker, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us.